This is F1 Debrief. Maybe they were all distracted by the lawn. Coming up this week, we talk shiny wing things, camping with Yamamoto, and why Red Bull like to be in control. When are we going to get ourselves a fancy new side podcast wing?
You fancy new building?
Well, if Silverstone can do it, why can't I?
Well, we don't have the backing, and you know what we also don't have? We don't have Damon Hill. He's a man who gets things done.
He hasn't got much to do, though. He's retiring from the BRDC, isn't he?
Do you think he'll come work for us?
He must be.
Like a shiny new side podcast HQ.
He must be at a loss for
big
things.
Big pointy
to
roof.
Good week, bad week.
It's been a good week for Virgin fans as the team put on a camping extravaganza. Drivers turned up, celebrities turned up, even you turned up.
Our gate crashed, yeah. Temporarily.
There was a giant screen, food from Jamie Oliver's restaurant, and Sakon Yamamoto DJ'd. They are definitely doing it again next year as well, so they have confirmed that on Twitter.
Wonderful. I cannot speak more highly of it. If you're into camping, it's a bit like the Dreamfields thing we went to with Honda, if you cast your mind back.
I vividly recall.
It's slightly less posh because it's open to the public and therefore there isn't a free bar. But that's the only thing. It's
probably
the only real
thing.
Difference. Yeah, that would have helped you greatly. That's the only major difference. It's good. It's, you know, there's no more Dreamfields because there's no more Honda. But thankfully, Virgin have picked up that baton and boy, are they running with it.
It's been a bad week for art as Force India revealed their art car. It's for charity, so the concept is good. They brought in Dexter Brown, who is apparently a renowned motorsport artist, and he got to paint the livery. It's the same orange and green that you might expect on a Force India car, but it's all a little bit blobby, I guess is the word. It's going to be auctioned off later in the year. I think I could paint that, and I'm really rubbish at art.
You're not appreciating the subtleties of the Force India art car. It's abstract expressionism.
Oh.
That's what it is.
I missed
it's
that bit.
Over your head there. I think it's a good week for art.
It's been a good week for cricket as Formula One is getting involved. The Lotus team installed some nets in the grounds of the factory. Initially, it looked like it was just for recreation. There were some photos of Karin Chandak wearing those big old leg things. But they tweeted...
I have no idea what they're called. I can't help you out. Knee pads?
Maybe. They tweeted they were taking on another village team, Marlingford. The results came via Twitter too. They were 92 all out, first scoreboard ever, just came a few runs short in the run chase, but still a great effort for a first test. I don't know what that means either, but it sounds good. It's been a bad week for decision making as Formula One went back and forth on the diffuser nonsense and finally decided that it was fine as it was. I've put this in good week, bad week and not a news item of its own because that's all I have to say on it, really. It was stupid.
The only thing I have to add is yet again, for the second time this year, the FIA has shown a distinct lack of direction. They looked entirely clueless throughout the entire affair, and again, no good came of their involvement.
News and views.
It seems like news goes in cycles of whichever team is dominating headlines, because it was HRT recently. They had Daniel Ricciardo, as he is called.
I call him Ricciardo.
Yeah.
There's an I in it.
I know. It sounds better as well, but he himself says it's Ricciardo.
He's wrong.
Then there was Colin Collis was going to take a step back, and then they were bought out by Taysan Capital. They're an investment company from Spain. They've bought a majority shareholding and they want to make the team more Spanish. I'm not sure how Ricciardo fits into that plan.
He's not very Spanish, is he?
He's a bit Australian.
Have we not talked about Mr. Ricciardo? Did that not come up in the last show? Has that happened between debriefs?
No, I think we have talked about it, but the point is they've been bought out now, so...
We were discussing the possibility they might be bought out in the last debrief, and then they went ahead and got bought out.
Now they have.
Okay, so are they on more stronger footing? Are we more positive about where they're going to go?
Who knows? I've never heard of this Taysan Capital
thing. The good news is they are Spanish, which means the point of HRT is that, you know, Hispania is supposed to be Spanish, so at least now that dream... has a better chance of becoming a reality. So
just like Force India. Anyway, Virgin, they confirmed a deal with McLaren to become technical partners, which it means getting access to the wind tunnel and sharing staff. So it's sort of like, we went down the wrong path and now we need you to tell us how this wind tunnel business works.
This is an interesting story because we know McLaren had a similar tie-up with Force India in the past. And since then, McLaren and Mercedes have separated into their own teams. And I'm wondering if McLaren are looking for a more specific focus. We've got the rest in Force India, so that there is some tie-up that is working. But they may have decided they want to get more out of a more direct tie-up with Virgin. And it does sound like Virgin have the most to gain from this up front.
Yeah.
They're getting staff into their factory, and they are moving factories, I think, at the end of this year as well. So they're all moving to one place. And that's going to be a big change for them. I don't know quite what McLaren gets out of it. So there must be some kind of, there's IP transfer one way, but what's coming back towards McLaren and why are they so keen to reach out to these smaller teams? I'm not quite fathom in it.
And McLaren don't really have any spare drivers that they want a seat for. I mean, what, Gary Paffett, he's just been renewed. I don't see him turning up in a Virgin anytime soon.
No, again, it's slightly confusing, but it's not the first time. It's the second time they've done this. So they're determined to make something work, or they've found some value in doing this, and so they're going to continue with it. But it's lost on me what that advantage is to them.
I guess they get extra testing miles, extra data coming back to them, don't they?
The good news is Virgin have a plan now. We've been questioning since they ditched their CFD idea exactly where they're going to go with it, you know, what direction they're going to go in, because they didn't seem to have the manpower or the experience or any strength in depth to really push that team forward. You know, they've got a lot of catching up to do to stay ahead of to keep up with Lotus and what their plans are. At least now it looks like they could be like a big leap forward next year. They've got they've got a plan and they've got a direction, and it's all going to come together for 2012, maybe.
And there was another team tie-up which got people very, very excited that we will see a Williams Renault on the grid for 2012.
Bit of nostalgia there.
Well, it's lost on me, really, because I never saw that car.
No, you must have read, you must have seen the yellow and the white and the blue livery, that kind of, that
I've
era. You must know, yeah, you know all about it. I mean, it's Formula One folklore. The thing, from my point of view, less of the nostalgia, but more of a thank goodness, because the Cosworth engine we know has not lived up to expectations. Obviously, they couldn't afford anything else, so they had to go with that. And now they too have found a way to move forward, because that engine isn't helping them in the slightest. And finally, it looks like they might be able to claw some of that performance loss back, thanks to Renault. And yes, it's nice that Williams Renault are back together. It's nice that they're running in a retro livery, but let's see some retro performances, and then we'll be talking, because that's what we all want from Williams. We want to see them move close to the front, and Renault should help them do that.
Qualifying.
As you would imagine, when Formula One turns up to Silverstone, it starts to rain.
But would you have it any other way?
Well, it depends if I'm there or not.
As somebody sitting it at home in the warm and dry, would you have it any other way?
Well, Friday wasn't that interesting,
no,
even at home.
Bit of a washout.
Yeah.
We've talked at great length about drivers and cars and teams not running in the wet.
Yeah,
and how
I don't
much...
want to talk about it again.
I know, but I did just want to point out that I think it was Mike Gascoigne said during free practice on Friday, there's no point us running during practice, because if the conditions were like this, they would red flag it.
Yeah.
That was what Mike Gascoigne said, unprompted. That was his words. Because we don't run in the rain on a Sunday, we're not going to practice in the rain on a Friday. And that right now sums up Formula One's problem. Does it not?
Yeah, it wasn't great. And I think that the people that did brave Friday and sat in the grandstands, I mean, at times it was pouring, sometimes it wasn't so bad. They need a refund.
It's freezing cold, it's soaking wet, and none of the teams can be bothered to go out on track. I would be fuming if I was there. I think in free practice two, there was half an hour of running. That's all the fans got to see. There were quite a lot of people there. When the cameras panned around, I couldn't see that many fans. And it was kind of like, well, did nobody bother turning up? It was a bit like Turkey. You know, Friday, nobody's there. And I spoke to some fans on Friday evening, and they said it was packed. So I don't know where all the fans were hiding. But if I had paid money for Friday, I would have been very, very disappointed in what I saw for what I paid. Because there was nothing to look at.
No. There were times when it did look like it probably was too wet to go out, but that wasn't all day. And
no.
I think at some time, I don't know, perhaps they're also still worried about tyres and all these things, but there needs to be something, some motivation for them to go out on a Friday.
Formula One is broken in the wet. I don't care what anybody says now. We have the evidence to prove it. Formula One in 2011 is broken when the weather is vaguely inclement and it needs fixing.
Qualifying was not so wet, although in the top 10 shootout, there was a shower that stopped them doing a second run, so we knew who was on pole position halfway through, which is pretty much what qualifying has been like all the time this year.
The good news is it looked like if the rain hadn't come, drivers were ready to do another time. They were scuppered by the rain, but thankfully, due to prevailing conditions, Mr. Vettel didn't get pole.
Nope, it was Webber.
Yes, finally got
still
the
Red
better
Bull
of the guy. I mean, in variable conditions, he did a better job. He made better use of that car. The continuing controversy over the engines didn't seem to make any difference to the Red Bull's pace. They were still out in front by a considerable margin. McLaren's were slow, seemed slower because of the changes. But Webber did the business. He finally managed to get one over Vettel for the first time this season.
Yeah, McLaren's struggled, and I think Renault also struggled quite a lot. Paul de Resta, he qualified really well. Sixth place, which I think is his highest so far.
Must be. Yeah, that was a great run from him.
Kobayashi and Maldonado were also up there.
It was a good top 10.
The top 10.
Pastor Maldonado has out-qualified Rubens Barrichello four times in the last five races, which is a surprise given how much grief I've given the poor chap.
The race. Where better to start than at the beginning? Vettel stole that lead from Webber. It's almost as if Webber wasn't in front at all.
I'm not entirely sure whether or not they've got the pole position and second position the right way around on the track. It was where the racing line was. It seemed like the natural place to put it. But the way Vettel breezed past Webber, we'll have to see in a couple of years' time whether or not they don't decide just to swap them around, because it did seem like Vettel had the advantage from second.
However, a bungled pit stop by Red Bull, which is not something you see every day, that lost Vettel his inherited lead.
It was going so well until that point, and we don't usually see such a mistake from Red Bull. Red Bull have been, I think, the fastest team.
Or if there is a mistake, it is not with Vettel.
No, they've certainly been the fastest team when we do pit stop comparisons. A lot of the time, they've got a pretty high, good percentage. And when it comes to their favourite guy, their lead driver, mistakes don't usually happen. But in this instance, a bit of luck went Ferrari's way. Alonso took the lead and he never surrendered it after that point.
No, it could be something of a lucky win. But at the same time, he really did have the pace. He wasn't going to be caught at the end, was he? He had quite a gap.
We were slightly robbed of a grandstand finish between Alonso and Vettel. I think the way that Webber caught up with Sebastian meant that he didn't have the pace come the end of the race. And it would have been Alonso certainly had the pace. He stretched out his lead and he was gone. I think Ferrari, we saw some weakness in Ferrari when their tyres were cold. We've seen it before. But certainly when Fernando was out on cold tyres, Hamilton did manage to breeze past him. Was into Copse, a fantastic overtaking manoeuvre from Hamilton.
Yeah.
But what I really like about that duelling is that Ferrari was slow for a period and Alonso and Massa would just sort of hang back and not get into any trouble and let cars pass them. And then the speed came to them and then they would just make those places back. It was a lot of to and fro and based on which cars made the best use of their tyres at which point in the race. Button struggled early, but then came good later in the race. You know, when the fuel lows went down, his tyres got better too, much like the Ferraris.
Button also did a good overtaking move or two.
I loved his move on Massa. That was incredible. It was good overtaking up and down the field.
There was good stuff throughout the race. Unfortunately, it was a little bit of a heartbreaking end for Button, who would have wanted to do well in front of his home crowd.
Now, he had really bad luck in the pit stops.
His team properly let him down.
Who do you blame? Point the finger at somebody.
It was the lollipop man's fault.
Mm-hmm.
Because the wheel gun man went to put the wheel nut on. It didn't work, so he went for his spare one and the lollipop man lifted as though he'd finished.
See, I would put the blame on the jack man, because the jack guy had the car back on its wheels when one wheel hadn't come off, and therefore the lollipop guy realised the jack man was out of the way. And ultimately, he does have the final responsibility. But the car, there's no point putting the car down when the front right wheel hadn't even been changed. It was still the original tyre. So somewhere along the line, it all fell to pieces.
Yeah.
Prior to Jensen's stop, I think we saw one of the mechanics losing a wheel nut and having to go and retrieve it from across the pit lane because it ran away from him. And then when Jensen came in, they had another problem with the front wheel nut. So it didn't look like they really, they weren't confident and composed and prepared before Jensen came in. It was all a bit of disarray.
Yeah, but then they're not the only ones. We also saw, obviously, the Vettel thing. Force India had a bit of a pit stop problem. There were unsafe releases all over the shop. It seems like the pit lane was just not the place to be.
Kobayashi caused chaos by running over. He exited too quickly and he made his own unsafe release. He just went when he wasn't supposed to. And then he managed to run over half of Force India's equipment. And then Paul de Resta came along and he didn't have any tyres. So he just sat there looking lost.
Yeah.
Poor chap.
Well, because he'd bashed into or collided with, I can't remember whose fault it was, into Buemi. So he came into the pit lane unexpectedly. So they were sitting there with Sutil's tyres and in comes a different driver.
That delayed de Resta and it delayed Sutil because he was following in ready for his planned stop.
Yeah, and his tyres had been sitting out of their blankets waiting.
Yes, a busy old pit lane. It was a nice pit lane with new grass around.
Maybe they were all distracted by the lawn.
Do you think?
Yeah.
They were just, it put them into a relaxed mood instead of into race mode. Maybe that's what it was.
Let's have a voicemail now from possibly Sauber's biggest fan, RG.
Hi, it's RG. I just heard about the British Grand Prix. Right from the start of Checo decided that aquaplaning off going at 10 miles an hour in the parade lap was a smart move, and he just went swimming in the grass. Well, he actually did well right until Schumacher hit him, which, for the record, personally wasn't Schumacher's fault. Well, it was Schumacher's fault, but it was more of a racing incident. And then engine failure, which is the first time of the season for Sauber.
Was it RG?
Yes.
You sure?
Yes.
Absolutely sure?
Yeah, I think so.
Are you convinced about that, RG?
Well, for Kobayashi anyway. I'm not sure.
Oh, okay.
Perez, probably I shouldn't talk about this before I've done the facts. But.
Don't we love RG? Yeah, Perez, poor Perez.
You're talking over voicemails now.
Yeah, poor Perez was...
I forgot about that.
Yeah, he went off, didn't he? He came and got... Before, he had a nose chase before the race even got going.
That's a bit tricky. He still made it back out to the grid, though.
He did
so that
fine.
Was good work.
You know, I don't know. Maybe he was just, you know, exploring the runoff to know the limits. But, he was finding the limits of the car.
It was weird because half the track was soaking wet and half was dry, so I suppose it was...
It wasn't weird, it was challenging.
Yes.
And a little bit too challenging.
Sorted the men from the boys.
Mr. Perez.
There was something interesting to say about Schumacher's collision with Kobayashi, because he got a 10-second stop-go penalty for that, and actually we saw a couple of those penalties. And apparently they had to use them because the pit lane is so short that if it was just a drive-through, it would have only been something like 8 seconds, which is not penalty enough.
Yes, there was a problem when driving through the pit lane, you'd actually gain time on people who'd gone around the track because of the way it sort of slices off a corner. Unfortunately, that's just the way it's designed. It might have to be redesigned in the future.
Yeah.
Because it's not good. I did want to give a huge, huge shout out, though, to Mr. Nigel Mansell, who was the race steward for this race. And on the BBC Forum post-race, he did something that I don't think any other steward has done since we've had driver stewards in Formula One, and that is he explained a decision for us. And when he sat down and explained it, it made an awful lot more sense. The question put to him was, why was it that Michael Schumacher got a penalty for running into Kobayashi when Paul de Resta didn't for running into Buemi? Which, and both incidents on paper looked quite similar. And you could argue, actually, that's an inconsistent stewarding decision. And if Nigel Mansell hadn't said anything after the race, we'd probably be debating that right now. But what he did do, he said, look, we looked at the data and we could tell that Michael Schumacher was out of control when he hit Kobayashi. You could tell from his entry speed and the way he was driving, we looked at the data, that guy was not in control and therefore he got a penalty. Paul de Resta, his front wheel was alongside Buemi, and therefore when the incident happened, he was in control of the car. They just disagreed on the same piece of tarmac. Therefore, that was a racing incident. And having a driver steward just explain those very, very, very simple facts. He didn't reveal anything. You know, he didn't give away any secrets about stewarding. He just told us what happened, why they made the decision, and it made such a blooming big difference.
I bet there would still be some debate. But yes, it would be good.
We should have that
for
all decisions. All you need is some guy after the race to say, this is why we decided this. This is why we decided that. We came to these conclusions because of A, B, C, and D. It's not that complicated. It would take seconds.
Maybe,
put in a press release.
Maybe no one's ever actually asked them directly.
They have. No, they did. Someone asked, was it F1 Pulse, asked McNish about decisions after whenever he did some stewarding. And he said, I can't talk about it. I can't talk about it. It's a secret. Just don't ask me any questions about it. Like, why not? Just tell us why you made your decisions, please. And Nigel was just happy just
he
to
did
talk.
Say, I mean, when he sat down, he said, I can't say too much. And then he went on to say quite a lot.
Which
so
is
that
perfect.
Was good. Whilst we're talking about stewarding, it's probably worth mentioning Hamilton, who didn't need any.
Hamilton was fantastic.
Yeah.
He really was. Like we said, the pass on Alonso was great. Really loved his driving. Clean. I think he managed to crash into Massa on the penultimate corner of the race, which is fine because he didn't need the wing after that. He did. I mean, he didn't get through the race.
Through it,
he so. Didn't get through the race without knocking someone off the track, which is a shame. But actually, it was so late in the race, it didn't matter. And they finished the line 0.0 seconds apart, which is fantastic.
I mean, his race was a little bit scuppered as well, because towards the end, the team were telling him on the radio that he didn't have enough fuel and he had to slow down. So he was having to back off, couldn't hold up his position from
Mark Webber.
And had to try and keep Massa behind him, which he did to a point.
Yes, it didn't. He wasn't too happy about that decision. There was a reason for it. What was the reason?
Well, I do believe that it might have been a bit of Ted news.
Ted news.
The team thought that because he qualified 10th, they thought that at the start he would be caught up in a bit of traffic. Obviously, Maldonado was ahead of him.
He was 10th. He was in a bad position.
Yeah, Kobayashi. Some cars that he would probably have to get past. But he got past them a lot earlier than they thought.
The conditions played into his hands, and maybe McLaren hadn't accounted for that. However, I will raise your TED news with some Pat news. Pat Simmons on the Fan Vision podcast, I listened to it yesterday, and he came up with a really good point. And that was, at the start of the race, Lewis Hamilton had less fuel on board than all of the other drivers around him.
That's true.
And when he was faster than all of the other cars at the beginning of the race, and he was overtaking them and looking, you know, making himself look great and scything his way through the field, he wasn't complaining about the lack of fuel then. He only complained about the lack of fuel at the end of the race. And I thought that was a really interesting point. You know, yes, obviously he lost a position towards the end of the race, but I still think it did help him at the beginning. And you can't have it both ways.
I think when he was interviewed after the race, he didn't seem too upset about it. We'd heard team radio where he was saying, "You're not giving me enough information. This is not on. I don't know what I'm doing." But afterwards, he seemed quite okay with it, and he was even joking like it wasn't until the last lap that they said I could get on with it again.
Yeah, it was. Qualifying for once, qualifying wasn't the team's mistake. Lewis didn't get the lap in that Jensen did, and then the rain came down and he couldn't get another lap in. So it was, his position was on his shoulders. It was his own doing, and therefore he couldn't have that much to complain about. But, you know, good on him. He made the race exciting and I enjoyed watching him.
10th to 4th is not bad going.
Not at all.
Hi guys, Lukey here. Silverstone. I mean, what a race. What a great race. I'm a big fan of Silverstone anyway. I really do enjoy Silverstone, and I know that's just absurdly British, but I'm very proud of Silverstone. I love that they've done all this work, and it's in the 21st century. It's not in the 17th century anymore, and it's not a big hole in the ground caused by Simon Gillette. It is awesome, and today we had an awesome race. Bit of everything, bit of this, bit of that, back to normal.
Are we proud of Silverstone?
It looked all right.
It looked fantastic. I really did like the work they've done. One thing I was slightly embarrassed about was on Friday, I didn't recognise anything.
No.
And I felt like a bit of a bad Formula One fan because I couldn't fathom where on earth they were on the track. I spent most of Free Practice 1 looking bamboozled and the rest of Free Practice 2 trying to learn where everything was. It wasn't the Silverstone that we know and love. It was a greater Silverstone, but albeit a slightly confusing one.
I did get very discombobulated by the fact that there were two sets of grid markings, because I would look up and go, "Oh, look, he must be on the home straight," and you'd say, no, that's the old grid.
That's like, the GP2 grid.
I don't know where he is then. I got very annoyed.
They have two sets of pits. I don't know if they're going to retain those, but GP2 obviously got a very good service.
It's the only bit of the track I can definitely know where I am is where they've got grid markings. And
right.
Not here.
There were complaints. It wasn't perfect. I mean, they've done a fine job with the building. There were complaints from fans about the depth of the pit lane, though, because from Williams down, when a car went into the pit lane, it just vanished from sight.
Yeah, Louise on Twitter said, "If you sit in the pit straight, the cars disappear from view after Williams." But apparently, this is only a temporary problem.
Well, it is a temporary problem if they can find the money to build the new hotel and grandstands opposite the pits, in which case they'll make them higher, and then you can see inside it. However, until that happens, and we don't know when that might be, it basically depends on when the BRDC have enough money to make those changes. In the meantime, those cars will just disappear. And if you're a fan in the grandstand, you can't see them, and that is a problem. It's the top teams. It's the teams that most of the fans are there to see. I mean, most of the people in the grandstands were wearing Vodafone rocket red hats. And when the McLaren boys came into the pits, nothing to see.
It might be a good thing that they couldn't actually see when Button came to a stop.
Yeah, I think he might have just popped out. Just popped his nose out enough to stop.
Rolando sent me a message with his thoughts on the race and on Silverstone. It says, "Great racing this weekend. I must say, it does feel nice to see a different face on the top step, even if it was Alonso. If it had to be a Ferrari driver up there, Massa would be the preferred guy in my eyes. I'd give Silverstone a 10 out of 10, mainly for the sweet new cable cam. Take that to every track, please. Pretty please. Would have loved to see Lewis get a podium today, but his scrap with Felipe was quite yummy. Two tasty battles to end the race really made it a grand finale." New cable cam.
I don't wish to take anything away from Silverstone, but was it the Nürburgring that did it first, or was it Hockenheim? One of the German tracks has been doing that for the last decade. not taking
no
anything away from
No one said it was new. It's just brilliant.
I can't wait for the day when cable cam goes all the way around the track. It was in a great position. It crossed several parts of the track, so you could see the cars for a great length of time. But one day, cable cam will definitely be able to follow all the cars, you know, at full speed. It's getting quicker and quicker. And one day it will just run all the way around the track, and I'm looking forward to that day. It's nice. I enjoyed it. It's not original, and it will get better.
The new track actually inspired a first-time caller to Side Podcast. This is Nolinio.
The first thing to say is the new start-finish rate works an absolute treat. It's great to see a nice corner where they can be flat out through the first turn and not get unnecessarily bunched up. But also the new layout of the track is very good. One of the things, although I do love the old Silverstone circuit, it wasn't really particularly good for racing. I think sometimes we think of Silverstone with tinted glasses and we think it's fantastic because us Brits anyway, when actually in reality, a lot of the races we've had in the last kind of 10 years or so haven't always been the best. But I think with the track change as it is now, it's pretty good. It's great to see the fans on the track at the end of the race as well. I know we've not seen that for a while. Fantastic to see. The fans love it. There's no point stopping them.
They definitely didn't allow track invasions when I was there.
I do believe it was illegal. So yes. On the big television screens, it is illegal to enter the track after the race.
Well, they opened it up later on when everyone was gone and it was starting to rain.
Is this because of the way, has it been designed to allow track invasions? Have they changed something, or have they just decided, we'll just let them come on the tarmac?
Who knows? In the BBC forum, they asked Damon Hill whose idea it was, because it was a really great idea, and he said, yeah, it was my idea, which you would say if someone had just told you it was a brilliant idea.
It may have been, though. So, I mean, he's an ex-driver. He remembers the times when fans were allowed to invade the track. At Monza, they're still allowed to invade the track. In Australia, it never went away, but for some reason at Silverstone, it became illegal.
And now it's not illegal anymore.
And that's fantastic. We will applaud Damon Hill and everybody for the work they've done at Silverstone, because, again, that's another fantastic thing to bring back.
I do think the fans that got onto the track will be very lucky, because there was a lot of debris scattered around, so I bet a lot of people went home with souvenirs.
Yes, there was some front wings and all sorts of bits, carbon fibre for the collection, and I'm sure they did, if the marshals hadn't already got there.
There is one subject we sort of haven't touched upon yet, and that might be the Red Bull team orders thing.
Did we get some voicemails on this, perhaps?
We got a couple. Yeah, let's begin with Kai.
Hey, Christine and Mr. C, this is Kai, and I am calling from London. How about that? This was an incredible race for me to be able to turn on the TV and just be able to see the BBC coverage right there. And I yelled at EJ. It happened. And to be able to watch the race with someone else in the room commenting, the final was there, and it was absolutely an incredible experience, really. The drama of the whole race. I mean, when Jensen's lug nut wheel nut was not put on correctly, I was absolutely heartbroken at that time. And then at the end, when Weber was coming on, and then he was given the directive by the team, I was absolutely irate. I was very, very angry.
Hi, Christine and Mr. C. Lorenzo from Melbourne, Australia. I felt compelled to call into you guys today after what was a fantastic race in Silverstone over the weekend. It built nicely to a climax in the final laps. I think a wet and dry race that would have seemed like we'd have been cheated if it had been dry the whole way through, considering every session before the race had some wet and dry element. Oh, speaking of being cheated, what on earth were Red Bull thinking, telling Mark Webber to hold his position four laps from the end, expecting him to cruise home behind his clearly more favourite teammate Vettel? Once again, Christian Horner has shown that he's nothing but Helmut Marko's puppet in a one-sided team that has on numerous occasions shown blatant favouritism towards Vettel. The worst part about this, the hypocrisy of the whole matter. Horner was very quick to point out last year that Red Bull was a team that lets its drivers race and they would never implement team orders. Yet as soon as there is a whiff of Vettel being beaten fair and square by Webber, they're on the radio begging Mark not to take the 3 points away from Sebastian. Yes, just 3 points we're talking about here, thereby reducing his lead to only 89 points to the nearest non-Red Bull driver in the Drivers' Championship.
Hello, Stephen Roy here. So far, we've seen Vettel dominate races and disappear in the distance and always be Mr. Reliable and nothing ever go wrong for him. and it had a bit of bad luck on a pit stop, but I think today the most significant thing is we may have seen the first real chink in his armour when he had the opportunity to race wheel-to-wheel with Lewis and either wouldn't take the opportunity or was unable to do it. I think that may be significant, and it may just be a nice little psychological problem, a nice little situation building up to see how he and Lewis react together when they're on the track now that he's shown that he's unable or unwilling to go toe-to-toe with Lewis. Perfect example of why I hate pit stops. But he just pitted and then drove in an empty piece of tarmac and was ahead when Lewis came out of the pits. Nothing to do with talent, nothing to do with ability. Just a pit stop that totally ruined any chance of there actually being an overtake.
Those are just snippets of the thoughts we got. You can actually hear full voicemails from everyone you've heard in the show notes, which will be on sidepodcast.com.
And they're worth listening to.
They definitely are, yes. Because obviously some of them go on for 5 minutes, 6 minutes, all good stuff, but we have to try and keep the show short. It never works. And if you want to leave us voicemails in the future, the number is 01212887225, or you can send MP3s to christine@sidepodcast.com.
And they are very much appreciated, especially for first-time callers.
Yes. So, Red Bull.
Yes, I cannot disagree with anything in those voicemails. I think Stephen is right on the money with Vettel and his inability to overtake. We must talk about that first. What did you make of that pass? Because I know you must have an opinion on this, because I recall you yelping in the middle of the race on Sunday. What did you say?
I did yelp. I may have said something like, oh my God, what a loser.
Yes. It has been stated time and time again that Sebastian Vettel is a driver who doesn't know how to overtake. And that was never more clear than at Silverstone on Sunday.
Yes. Well, this year, I mean, it's been said, but this year you can sort of say, well, it's not his fault. He's always in front. What can you do? He hasn't had a chance to prove himself. But today he really had that chance, and it was blatantly obvious that he doesn't know how to overtake. He said later that he got too close to Lewis Hamilton. I don't know if that's possible. You're too close to overtake. It was weird. He came up behind the car. He was close enough. He was beside it. He backed off. Then he was too close. He couldn't do it. It was rubbish.
Yes. You were embarrassed to watch that, weren't you?
Well, that's our world champion, our defending world champion, who's leading the world championship this year, and he can't even overtake a car. When we know it's possible, we saw Hamilton do it on a freakishly wet track.
Yes, Hamilton's pass was sublime. It was a wet track. He was on dry tyres. I still don't know how he managed to break that, you know, how he managed to slow that car to get into cops. That was amazing. However, he set the standard, and Vettel should have been able to do the same to him. But he was right in the sense that he got too close. He was so close to the back of Hamilton, he couldn't pull out without damaging his front wing. But the reason he was so close is because he doesn't know how to pass. He doesn't have the racecraft. He doesn't have the experience to know what to do with a car in that situation.
No, Stephen said that that's a perfect example of why he hates pit stops. And I can understand that. I disagree, because I don't hate pit stops quite so much as he does. But other cars do gain positions in races through the pit stops, but it's usually just because they can't overtake because of the aerodynamic reasons.
Mm.
But Red Bull brought him in specifically because he just physically couldn't overtake.
He didn't know what to do with his car in that position. And it didn't matter if he went round 100 times. It didn't matter how long that race was. Sebastian Vettel just had he ran out of talent. He had no ability and no concept of what to do with his car. And you had to, as a fan watching it, you really did feel like you could have done a better job. And that's embarrassing.
I didn't think I could, but I think a lot of people could have, but they don't get a chance in the car.
It's a crying shame. And Stephen is correct. There is a chink in the... I mean, the guy has plenty of chinks in his armour, actually. I mean, he's very, very weak under pressure. He only excels in a fast car up front. And he's just happened to have that for the last, however, you know, 9 months or whatever he's been, however many races he's been winning.
It makes me wonder how he managed to survive in a Toro Rosso.
He won his only race from first position, and he never had to pass anyone then.
However he managed to do it, Vettel did get ahead of a couple of cars. He was running second to the end of the race. Webber caught him up, tried to get past, even though his team told him not to. Now, team orders are allowed this year, so they didn't do anything wrong in that sense. But in the eyes of the fans, it was not the right thing to do.
No, we have a poll on Side Podcast. It's still open. If you're listening to this show, you are welcome to come and join. It will be open for another week after this recording goes out. You're welcome to come and have your say, have your vote, and have your, you know, voice your opinion in the comments. That's what it's there for. What does the vote currently stand at the point we record this?
Well, the question is, should Red Bull have let their drivers battle for second? And 80% say absolutely, whereas 20% say No way.
Okay. So, what is your opinion then on the team orders?
To a point, I understand why they did it. It was a team decision, all that nonsense. And I do understand that if they got to the end of the year, and I think, was it 3 points in it? And if they got to the end of the year and he lost by 3 points, they'd all look stupid. So I do understand those arguments. I'm not happy, as I do believe Mark Webber wasn't happy, with the suggestion from Horner afterwards that the only reason they didn't do it was because they would crash into each other, as though that was inevitably going to happen. Like, they're not capable of passing each other without crashing into each other.
They have a history of doing that once. In Turkey, the pair collided when Sebastian Vettel turned in on Mark Webber. So to me, what that says is Christian Horner knows that his lead driver is going to crash. Can't defend, actually, is what I was going to say. Christian Horner must assume that not only can Vettel not overtake, he can't defend either cleanly.
Brilliant.
So he doesn't trust, whatever the case, he doesn't trust somebody in that team. That is abundantly clear. I think we knew before Red Bull's position after Turkey, when they steadfastly defended Vettel, despite it being entirely his fault, and frame by frame analysis and evidence after the race has proven it to be Vettel's all Vettel's doing unequivocally. You know, there is no debate on that whatsoever. Despite that, Red Bull defended him to the end, to the very end, and I don't think even now they've ever admitted that it was his fault. So we know Red Bull's position. I think the problem you have with the fans is that, on the one hand, you know where Ferrari stand. You know that Ferrari are going to use team orders. You know what, they have a clear number one, they have a clear number two. You know exactly what they're going to do before they go into the race. It's not a surprise when Ferrari pull that card. In the same way that, you know, when McLaren go into a race, they will let their drivers fight equally, corner after corner, lap after lap, turn after turn. We've seen it time and time again. You know that going into the race, McLaren will let them race come what may, sometimes, you know, to their own detriment. But in the end, they're a racing team and they let their drivers race. With Red Bull go into the race saying one thing, we'll let our drivers race, but they actually do something different, which is they call team orders.
Yeah.
And that, to me, I think is the issue.
It was also a bit awkward because it comes on the back of this time last year at Silverstone, where Webber won the race, saying not bad for a number two driver. So exactly the same problem a year on. Still going through the same thing.
Christian Horner post-race looked like a rabbit in headlights. He's terrible at lying, and it's very difficult to trust anything he says.
I think it was very key when he said it was a team decision, not my decision, a collective team decision, which just means it came from up high.
It came from Helmut Marko.
Yeah.
What it means. There is one sliver of evidence to defend Red Bull in this situation. And I should probably have checked my facts before going down this route, but I'm going to take a punt on it. I think in Turkey, possibly in 2009, the roles were reversed. Webber was in front of Vettel, and they told Vettel to hold station. And after the race, when questioned about it, Christian Horner said, "We let them race until the last five laps," or it might have been the last pit stop back then, but until the very last section of the race, the guys can race out, and then once they're in those positions, that's it. And if that's Red Bull's policy, they are at least consistent, because it was the last five laps of the race or whatever, and they, you know, he said, okay, now you hold station. And Webber benefited from that policy once, and he didn't benefit from it in Silverstone. And therefore, if that's, you know, if that's always been their policy, and it may well be the case, and Webber should know that, then he was naughty to do what he did. Having team orders is not a good thing in Formula One. Disobeying team orders, I think, is worse. Because if you start disobeying team, you know, if you start ignoring the team, where does that end? Where will that lead to?
It is a team sport, after all, isn't
it? I mean, you have to, there comes a point when you have this contact with the pit wall. You have to listen. And in some ways, you come across as maybe a bit of a sheep, and Webber's always keen, you know, to be an individual and to make his point and to stand out. What I do know is that it's going to be hard for him to stick around in that team. The way he's been acting at the moment, if I was Christian Horner and I had a driver disobeying my instructions from the pit wall, I would have him out of that car as fast as I possibly can. So whether or not you agree with what Webber did, I just don't think he's going to stick around very much longer.
The real shame is that I think the overriding thing of this weekend is just negative towards Red Bull. And what I don't understand is all the individual parts are actually, they're all right. I mean, Webber is fine. He's nice. Vettel was on Top Gear after
hilarious
British Grand Prix. really funny.
Yep.
Great. He seemed a very nice guy.
Good guy.
Horner was also on a Top Gear. Was that before?
Yeah, he was going around Monaco.
Yeah. Seemed all right.
Hilarious.
Adrian Newey, he's all right. He's a bit prickly maybe, but he seems a very nice guy.
Matichic is okay. And I suspect Helmut Marko is actually an okay guy.
I even quite like Red Bull as a product.
You put the whole things together and it just goes boom.
It's horrible.
Yeah, it is. I genuinely think it's because they try and put across this image that they are, you know, they're a high-end, extreme sports kind of thing. You know, they have the air race and they have all these...
Crashed ice
and that kind of thing. And those things go really well when they can control the whole experience. When it's end-to-end Red Bull and they are 100% in control, they can handle the PR. And in Formula One, they can't have a 100% say in what happens and how things happen. And they're fighting against other teams. And that doesn't work so well for them. We've seen them, I think they're backing out of NASCAR because they're doing really, really badly in NASCAR. And it's not selling drinks because they're not winning. And in Formula One, they've managed to win, but they've still not got the PR thing under control. And maybe they're just destined to be very good at hosting their own sports where they're just the sponsor and they can't lose.
It seems today, in Formula One, that what we say isn't much obeyed. But Stephen Roy definitely knows a thing about a young boy from West Lothian. Paul de Rester is a rookie, so should we lay a fiver with the bookie? Tell us, Stephen, nice and quick, no need for a song or for a dance. Was it a cross or was it a tick?
I like what you did there.
You proud of that?
Yep.
Pleased with that one.
It was the pits that he went wrong in the pits.
You know, explaining it ruins the moment.
Moving swiftly on then, I had a message from Relax Driver who said, liking the last podcast, I would love for you to spend some time following Ricciardo more closely.
Ricciardo.
As he's finally starting a race. We've been following Paul de Rester and it would be nice to have another rookie followed closely. Don't worry about following Maldonado. His braces are bothering, so we don't have to talk about him anymore. Also, Jerome is just boring. However, Danny, awesome. Please follow him.
I can't believe you just read out an email that called Jerome boring.
Well, it's blatantly wrong.
Blimey, Relax Driver, you are walking a fine line there.
I'm happy to do a report on Ricciardo, but it needs a fun title like Paul's Performance Report. Daniel's
Day Out. Daniel's Day Out. There you go. Okay, well, start Daniel's Day Out. Maybe we get a different opinion from somebody each race. You start this off, Daniel's Day Out.
Last.
Good. I can't argue with that at all. Thank you, Relaxed Driver.
Now we come to our little admin segments. Rate the race and driver of the day. Who's going to go first and which one are we going to do?
Blimey, driver of the day is going to be tough. I'm going to go for rate the race first.
Okay.
I can't think of much wrong with that one. Mixed conditions, check. Interesting pit stops, check. On-track collisions, check. Close battles, check. Racing to the last lap, check. Really, DRS zone, check. Everything worked. Everything came together nicely. I don't want to come across as like British and like pro Silverstone because I know that's easy to do. But genuinely, I don't know that there was much wrong with that race. I don't think I wanted for anything at any point. There was no downtime. I know when you were doing the fact by fact box, it was endless, wasn't it? There was no point when we could relax. There was no time to catch our breath.
No time to make a cup of tea.
Definitely not. It was no Valencia. So I'm finding it hard to mark this one down. Therefore, for the British Grand Prix in 2011, I'm going to give it a whopping 10 out of 10.
Well, that's mega.
And I'll tell you what tipped over the edge. Murray Walker commentated on the race on 5 Live.
He did.
You had the ultimate commentary team. You had David Croft, who is awesome in the commentary box. Alongside him was Anthony Davidson, who's an awesome co-commentator in the commentary box. And they were supplemented by Mr. Murray Walker commentating
awesome?
On the British Grand Prix. There were points when I just stopped what I was doing and I just enjoyed watching cars go round with Murray Walker commentating on things. And he hasn't lost it at all. He was absolutely on it 100% of the way. And do you know what? The first person... that I saw, and I was watching Twitter and I was watching side podcast comments and I was following the commentary on both BBC and BBC television and BBC radio. The first person I saw anywhere bring up the suggestion of team orders was Murray Walker. He was the man who said, do you know, guys, we could have a problem here because Mark Webber is catching Sebastian Vettel. And that was about 15 laps before it all kicked off. 10 out of 10 for this race, because where else is Murray Walker going to turn up and commentate alongside David Croft? I was in heaven. I'm going to watch that race again for that reason and that reason alone. I may just turn off the pictures and listen. It was bliss. Beat that every other race this year.
Well, not every other race this year is going to have Murray Walker. He is only wheeled out for the British Grand Prix. Something of a gimmick, you might say.
He's not. It's a fantastic gimmick. I will take that every year. I don't care. I will take no criticism of that man. He genuinely is a bona fide legend.
I would never criticise Murray Walker. Do you want to know my score? You're not interested. You're having a moment.
I got carried away there, didn't I?
Yeah.
I'll come back then to it. Sorry. Go on.
I am going to give it a 9 out of 10 because I did not like the fact it was overshadowed by all the diffuser nonsense. And I didn't like that team orders came into play, even if they're allowed, even if it didn't really make any difference in the end.
They were expected from my point of view, but I can understand. I totally see where you're coming from. I wasn't surprised.
Otherwise, it was a brilliant race all round.
Good stuff. Now you better do the driver of the day because I'm still thinking about it.
But yours was Murray Walker.
He's definitely man of the day.
You're going to override the rules, I bet.
Okay.
My driver of the day is Lewis Hamilton because he was pretty flipping awesome. And he did a lot of his overtaking moves before DRS was even enabled. We may believe he was on a lighter car, so he may have
been. He had a small advantage.
But I just think he did really well today and showed up other drivers for what they really are.
You're wrong. But I respect your opinion.
I usually am.
No, I think I can't argue with that. But there was a better driver out there today, and that was the man who won the race. Fernando Alonso may have benefited from the hot, cold, blown diffuser arguments. It may have brought Ferrari closer to the front. I don't think it gifted Fernando the win. He made it count in qualifying. He made it count in the race. I don't think there was anything else he could have done. You saw that kind of drive. You knew you could bet the farm on it. You knew that he wasn't going to, you know, there was no chance a wheel was going to go on the grass. 100% commitment. And he won the race. And it was a fantastic win. It was a deserved win. He put the work in. Ferrari have obviously put a lot of work in to bring a faster car. Also, I really liked the demo run that Alonso did before the race in the old Ferrari. I thought that was a really nice touch. I mean, I know it doesn't really count towards the race, but still, it was just a nice thing. So Lewis Hamilton did good. I cannot argue that that was a great drive. It's very close between the two of them, but I think Fernando Alonso was the better driver in the end, despite the fact most of his passes were DRS assisted. I think that you know, he made the very, very most of that car. And you saw where Massa finished in the same vehicle. And that's where he could have ended up, and he didn't.
That's always a good point. Feedback. After the last show, we had a tweet with some constructive criticism. It was from Bukoi, who said, I do love Sidepodcast, but wish they'd spend far less time talking about Sidepodcast. 15 minutes of a 53-minute show this time around. Yawn.
Oh, I'm sorry, but I disagree.
Well, he went on to clarify that he didn't like the feedback and all the talk about our apps and things like
yes.
that. Now, feedback I definitely disagree with because that's the whole point of Sidepodcast.
It is a community thing. I think you made a very good response. You responded on Twitter and said, Sidepodcast is a community and it's the bit of the podcast that talks to people. It's not you and I discussing things. It's where the community comes to the fore, and that is important. Also, I think, because a lot of people just listen to the podcast, it's also, you know, it's worth mentioning that we do have a website because, not, you know, there are more people listening to the show than there are visiting the website. And we occasionally have to remind people that they can come and interact and be part of the show. And the way you become part of the show is via the website. So we do have to plug that.
We do get people saying, listened for a while, first time visiting the site. So it does work.
Yes.
I can make it really quick and say, so here's some housekeeping. Buy the app, buy the book. That's a bit rude, don't you think?
You want to explain why people should do that?
Yeah.
I mean, if people just did buy the app and buy the book, maybe we could do less of this. Maybe that's the answer. I don't know.
But we should get on with it. Otherwise, Bukoi will be mad. I have to do a shout out to GUI89 on Twitter because we promised that we would. So, hi.
Is there a reason for that? I forgot why we promised.
I can't remember, but Hi, anyway.
Okay,
I had a message from Paul Alston who said, "Hi guys, firstly, thanks for reading out my comments on how friendly and respectful the drivers are this season. Yes, I wrote it before Monaco without realising how silly it would sound after Monaco, but it gave Mr. C a laugh, so it was definitely worth it. Secondly, I've come to the conclusion that DRS should be enabled after a number of corners rather than a number of laps. That way, the faster drivers would have less chance of opening a gap of more than a second and streaking away to the checkered flag. I know that for a number of reasons, this is to stop everyone except the leader DRSing together, but I can't help thinking that the FIA are missing a trick here and perhaps being a little overcautious."
Hadn't thought about that. Vettel
is capable of pulling out more than a 2 second lead in the first couple of laps, isn't he?
I wonder, you know what, I would like them to try it is the answer, because they've been very experimental with the use of DRS and how it's implemented and how they're tweaking the regulations. I wouldn't mind them giving that a go just to see, because you never know until you try it and it might work out.
I also had a message from Mark B, who says, "Warning, conspiracy talk to follow. So do you think that the FIA came up with this whole diffuser exhaust rule reinterpretation just to try to break the strong team unity that currently exists within FOTA, with pending discussions and Concord talks coming in the not-so-distant future?"
No.
I think they were just useless.
Yes. I don't think the FIA are the FIA of old that were capable of advantaging Ferrari at every possible opportunity. I think it's lacking in leadership, and when the negotiations come round, are up for renewal, remember that it's not the FIA that want to break FOTA, it's Bernie that wants to break FOTA. And Bernie didn't come up with this diffuser regulation. This is way beyond his level of dealings. I think what they tried to do was in the best interests of the FIA and the sport. What they were trying to do is to make F1 green, and they've been doing this over and over again. They're trying to curtail the wasting of fuel unnecessarily, which is what hot blown overrun is. It will get fixed next year because of the way that the rules have been reframed, and they were just trying to hurry it along, I think, and that backfired on them big time because they didn't understand the way the engines and the systems were being implemented. They didn't understand them well enough to make the rules fair for everybody. Not a big conspiracy theory, absolute ineptitude.
We do like conspiracy theories, though, so don't be put off.
I mean, I could be wrong. I'm not saying I'm right. I'm just saying I don't think the way it was handled.
In this instance, they were just useless.
Beyond useless.
Yeah.
Housekeeping.
I've got some iPad news. I've got some iPad news. I've got some iPad news.
Is it that the F1.com race edits now work on the iPad?
That is correct. I'd forgotten about that.
It's very good. Yes. It was F1 Petrolhead. Let me know that if you go to F1.com on your iPad, if you have such a device, it actually works on there now, which is good. It means it's not Flash.
It does, and it works on your iPhone too. Any manner of iDevices, and you can watch those videos on the move.
But that's not what you were thinking of.
No.
What news do you have?
I have excellent news. The F1 Minute app is now available on the iPad as of today. This is breaking news. We've been working on it. When did we release the iPhone app? It was about a month ago. Since then, we've been working on an iPad version, as promised, and it finally got released. And I think it's fantastic. What do you think?
Looks pretty good to me. If you have the app already on your iPod, then it becomes a universal app. So your update will be a free update, and you can get it on your iPad too,
mm-hmm.
if you want. Not an iPad 2.
No, it works on the iPad or the iPad 2. Yeah. But if you've bought it already, it's a free update. That's the important thing.
That's what I was trying to say. Or if you buy it now, it will work all over the place. It's brilliant.
It will work on every iDevice you have.
It also rotates, which it didn't before.
On the there's updates for the iPhone as well. So there's new. If you've got the iPhone app, you'll get benefits from this update. And there's more updates in the pipeline too. If you've got an iPad, this is a big update. And some people I know have been waiting since we released the initial app for this. So this is big news.
Yep.
And we'd love it if you downloaded it and if you gave us feedback and told us what you thought of it.
Well, we can't talk about it for too long.
We'll get into
trouble.
We don't
want to upset Bukoy. So just buy the app.
Buy the app. No excuses. Nothing more to say. Have you bought it yet? Go now.